Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Donna Anderson, the head of corporate governance at T. Rowe Price, a global investment management firm with $1.59 trillion of assets under management. Donna leads the policy formation process for proxy voting, chairs the firm's proxy committee, and leads the firm's engagement efforts with portfolio companies. She serves as a specialist for incorporating ESG considerations into the firm's investment research process. She's also a member of the firm's valuation committee and the Women's Roundtable Advisory Council. In addition, she serves on the advisory boards of the Council of Institutional Investors and the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. In this podcast, we talk about some of the surprising elements coming out of this proxy season, including issues connected to ESG, shareholder proposals and engagements, board diversity, stakeholder capitalism, private company governance, dual class share structures, and more. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Donna, it is so great to see you again. It's been a long time from back in the day at Stanford. Thank you very much for coming into the Boardroom Governance Podcast. It's great to have your voice in this very important area of engagement with companies on proxy voting and other asset managers, institutional investors' view on how companies should operate and how boards should operate. So thank you again for coming in.
Thank you, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start by something a little bit more personal, not necessarily from your professional background, but why don't you tell us where you grew up and we'll move from there into your current role at T. Rowe Price and we'll get to know you a little bit more.
Well, sure. I suppose the defining part of my upbringing was I was a daughter of a Navy pilot back in the 80s. My dad flew the planes that were listening for Russian submarines in the North Atlantic. So he was a career Navy pilot, and we moved every 2 to 3 years my whole life, including some stints overseas. That does create, I think, generally a more outgoing person, a little bit more adaptable person. I still get the urge to pack boxes and move every few years, even if I'm staying in the same city. I just start looking for a new house. So.
All right. And so from there, you went to Trinity University.
Right. Actually, I ended up there at a very early age. Honestly, I was 16 when I went there. And it was because my dad had just gotten orders to Texas. And I was just happened to be, you know, coming into my senior year. So we struck a deal at basically between my high school and Trinity. And I was able to go before I graduated from high school, technically, and did my last year at the same time as my freshman year.
Wow. So after that, you went to UT, University of Texas at Austin, to do your MBA. How was that path and thinking about the future? Did you always think about the finance industry as your career path?
Well, between my undergraduate and the MBA at Texas, I worked as a newspaper reporter for a few years in at a small daily in Washington State. And then I worked in the press and PR office for the State Department in Brussels. And so my pitch, which I guess worked to MBA school, was that becoming an investment analyst was really like an investigative reporter type job, only, you know, I really needed the finance and business education to complement the skills, you know, but you have to be resourceful, you have to communicate well, you have to be persuasive, and obviously you have to be good at research. So that's how I sort of translated those skills. But it was my objective going into business school to become a sell side or buy side investment analyst.
Great. And so tell us a little bit after, you know, how you started in the industry and your move into T. Rowe Price.
Yeah, I went straight from business school to a small buy side firm in Houston, a high net worth shop, where I followed stocks and, you know, was starting to develop, you know, spend some time with clients. But Invesco came calling, and that was a very intriguing opportunity because they really wanted someone. It was a director of research role, But at that firm, it was really more about kind of keeping the business of research running. It wasn't so much about coaching analysts and things like that. It was about a lot of different responsibilities, from sell side relationships to summer interns, recruiting, and voting the proxies. That was kind of one of the things they put on the plate for the mm-hmm. director of research role. And I did that. I was there for almost 10 years, and I was one of the few people there at the time who really liked the voting the proxies element of it. You know, this was a long time ago, so it was pre-ESG and engagement and all of that, but I really enjoyed that. And I had just started talking to a friend, actually, at the firm about, I wonder if this could be a specialty. I wonder if corporate governance could be like a thing that you specialize in, because I was getting kind of tired of that inch deep, mile wide, you know, sort of set a portfolio of responsibilities. And really, like the next day, I got a call from the director of research at T. Rowe Price saying they were thinking about establishing a specialty program in corporate governance, and would I like to talk?
Wow, that's really interesting. And it's really good to know the history a little bit of how governance has evolved, particularly towards institutional investors, a role in corporate governance and this proxy function. So why don't you tell us a little bit more for those listeners that are not that familiar with T. Rowe Price? What does it do? And, you know, what makes it different to maybe the passive investors and other institutional investors?
Well, yeah, as of our last public reporting, we have about a trillion and a half in U.S. dollars under management. And that has grown at strong pace in the last few years. This firm is virtually all active management. And so even strategies that we have that might be, for instance, in our multi-asset suite, where, let's say, a retirement date fund, where, you know, the asset allocation is done for you, it's still the underlying components of that strategy are actively managed T. Rowe Price funds. And so this is just a deeply rooted, it's a relatively simple business, which is nice. You know, it's really pure play asset management, and the culture here is just deeply rooted in fundamental investment research. There's never been a CEO of T. Rowe Price who didn't start out as an analyst on our staff. So, the way that corporate governance research and voting decisions had been made before my arrival in 2007 was on the PM's desk. You know, that those responsibilities were always, you know, considered part of the investment decision chain. But we were reaching a point at that time. This was, again, pre-global financial crisis, where, you know, we just were noticing a lot of sort of corporate governance related conflict with companies. It was over shareholder rights. It was over deals a lot of times, being taken private, for instance. There was just so much capital, remember, floating around back then, and a lot of great public companies were getting kind of taken out at what T. Rowe thought were unfair prices. And so, anyway, the decision to sort of marshal some resources and put in a specialty group was made on that basis. After the financial crisis, everything kind of changed and the mission has kind of tilted, but it was well timed, because clearly, you know, after we came out of that, between changes in regulation, the rise of ESG, you know, kind of global refocusing on the role of shareholders in managing systemic risks. Well, now, you know, everyone has a governance department, an ESG department, and the work is just much more clearly defined, the value that it adds. But that's how it started here, was just a need for specialty research role. We actually have a long history at this firm of internal specialists, where we can't find, you know, external data that meets our needs. So we have, you know, an internal quantitative analysis team. We have internal communications coaches that actually work with our analysts to help them on the, you know, their pitches and things like that. We have a person who just follows Washington, D.C. regulation, and how's that going to affect the portfolio? So we have going back in time, we have a long history of bringing in-house specialty expertise to sit inside the investment department and help PMs with these areas.
So one of the interesting evolutions of governance, if we think on a macro perspective, right, in the last 30 years, if you look at shareholder bases of companies, nowadays it's about, what, 70-75% institutional investors, whereas, you know, in the 1950s it was much, much smaller. And one of the things that this has created is the influence of large institutional investors over governance. And we've seen very large institutions and among them T. Rowe Price, but also the passive investors like BlackRock, like Vanguard, like State Street, which, as you said a bit earlier, have a strong influence in the agenda of corporate governance. And now there's a big surge of ESG. How do you think about your proxy voting? And there is a tension, I would say, between, you know, maybe a principles-based governance versus a case-by-case, right? And I think this would eliminate a lot of people, certainly would eliminate directors who should understand how do institutional investors think about their voting process.
Okay, you've given us a lot to unpack there, but let's start. I do want to start with a reminder, though, that T. Rowe Price itself, we don't own that many shares and stuff. Like we don't have house money, right? Mm-hmm. When you say we're a very large institution, we are representing all those smaller retail investors or pension plans, retirement savings schemes. So we that is really how we think of it. This is not us throwing our weight around. This is the interests of those clients that we're trying to represent. And the way that directly reflects itself in our process is every fund votes its own shares. So we do not view the vote as an asset of T. Rowe Price. It doesn't belong to me as head of governance. It belongs to the clients in each strategy. And to the extent that the same stock is owned across different strategies, but those managers view an issue differently, we vote differently. And so that's kind of how that manifests in the sense of who the vote really belongs to is something we never lose sight of. People do often ask us about sort of the differences or, how do we deal with the influence of passive investors? I'll just say I understand the reasons that their approach is different from ours, and I think of the approaches as complementary, not in conflict with each other. And the reason I say that is, if you have a passive strategy tied to an index and has to own everything in that index, it is in your interest to advocate and engage at sort of a higher level, at a policy level, right? To take a thematic view on some issue of shareholder rights or environmental risk or whatever, and to spread that message throughout, right, throughout the marketplace, because you're trying to, raise the level of that particular market, in that particular practice. We don't spend any time on the companies that we don't own, right? So our approach is still very much bottoms up, very much looking at each company, one by one, and each voting decision. But that's not to say that I'm really espousing anything differently or, trying to undo anything that a large index fund is doing. I think they're doing great work to escalate, elevate the standards market by market. We're just trying to spend our time and resources on directly on the investments that our clients own, which is only a subset of those. So the way we do that, thinking about policies, is we have a set of guidelines and nobody really gets wedded to those. That's how we think of them, is there's a basic set of guidelines that basically steer the ship in this direction on any given issue, but we spend all of our time, on the ground looking at whether that policy makes sense in this case, right? Like, is there an exception? And this year brought so many examples of that, right? We can believe in certain, requirements or certain, we take certain views about good compensation practices and bad compensation practices. Well, what do you do when the future of your entire industry is thrown into question by a pandemic that has, come through no fault of management, right? Our view is you got to be flexible about how did they respond to that and what did they do in compensation at that moment, given the uncertainty. So that's just an example of when the reality on the ground doesn't always match the principle.
And how many people work on your team doing this work, which would be very intensive because, you only look at, you said, the companies you own, but you do own a lot of companies anyway, right? And I think you voted about 65,000 resolutions. So that's a lot of voting that you do anyway, independently of the passive strategies.
Okay, so here's a small side note to explain some of those numbers. We actually do have a very small passive business at T. Rowe Price. We do have some clients who want to kind of park money with us in an index strategy. Mm-hmm. So the number and voting, public voting records don't reflect number of shares or the size of the holding or which fund it's in, right? They just say we voted this company, this date in this way. So actually we do have we have more than 95% of our AUM in active strategies. But in terms of voting, there is sort of an outsized effect in terms of the number of companies we do own. We have these massive, you know, these index funds that own massive slices of the market. So where we spend our time, again, is on the core holdings. But even then, it's a lot. We do look at every single vote. I mean, we don't have any autopilot kind of settings. We do think that we should be reviewing everyone. If for no other reason than just to make sure that our policy, our guidelines, since they are kind of loose, have been applied correctly, you know, for that situation. So because our analysts and PMs are so deeply involved and ingrained in this process, it doesn't take a lot of us. It doesn't take a lot of specialists to do this. We have a proxy voting team of usually three people. I have a partner who covers voting governance issues across Asia, Pacific, and EMEA, and I do North and South America. And then I should note, and we'll probably talk about this later, we have an entirely separate responsible investment team that does the ENS issues. So mm-hmm. just from a purely governance standpoint, that's our group.
So that's interesting, right? I don't know about you, but the way I've seen ESG evolve is historically, there's always been a lot of people focused on the ENS, and a lot of focus has been given to environmental issues. A lot of focus has been given on social issues, but typically they wouldn't really care less with the governance world. But as of late, ESG kind of put everybody together, and now the environmental and social people have, you know, are in the same agenda or have elevated kind of their issues to the board. And the last time I looked, there's about 1,900 global ESG funds. They've raised about $1.4 trillion. It's a huge asset place for companies and investments to be made. From your own data, I saw that T. Rowe Price had 1,002 engagements with companies in 2020, and 53% dealt with ESG matters. So I suppose now you have to work side to side with the ESG team, but how have you seen this ESG evolution within your own work in governance?
It is definitely fair to say that we agree these issues are intertwined. Mm-hmm. Our decision to separate them into two different functions is really just about kind of the workflow and the needs of our clients. But clearly, a company that is not well governed or doesn't have the right board in place is not going to be as effective at managing its long-term exposures, risks, opportunities to long-term environmental or social employee matters. So they are clearly intertwined, and we do find a lot of times that it makes sense to do that engagement that you mentioned jointly. But, you know, everything we need on the governance side to make a decision is a matter of public disclosure. I mean, really, there are very few markets in the world where we don't have what we need in terms of disclosure. And there's a periodic cadence to it, right? Because, again, every company that's at the equity side has to eventually go before its shareholders and have a vote. And the job of the responsible investment or ENS side is still very much around getting the data that they need, figuring out what's material and not, what's going to be useful or not, what's persistent and not. So, and there's no natural cycle to it necessarily. Companies disclose their ESG reports either not at all or all over the place in terms of the calendar. So those are the more technical reasons why we decided these are actually separate disciplines, but we do clearly, you know, work together constantly. The engagement approach here, the 1,002 meetings you mentioned, that would encompass meetings led by our responsible investment specialists, meetings led by a governance specialist, or meetings led by an analyst or portfolio manager that just have a substantial amount of their agenda dedicated to these issues, right? So it really depends on the circumstances and sort of what the initial concern was, either on the company's part or ours. A lot of them are fixed income related, and so deal with sometimes a different set of issues. And a lot of them are what we would characterize as kind of coaching sessions. I mean, we have a very disproportionately large footprint, for instance, in small mid-cap investments. And there really are a lot of companies in those portfolios that are just at the beginning of their ENS journey, right? Their reporting journey, disclosure journey, or even, you know, basic issues like diversity and inclusion, right? Just getting started on those. Mm-hmm. They're looking for coaching from their investors. And we are often very large investors in those names. And so we're happy to kind of serve that role all the way to the other end of the spectrum, you know, companies that are really quite sophisticated in these areas, and we're calling them to dig into one specific area or one specific event that's taken place that we might have concerns about. So,
and can you elaborate a little bit more on the coaching? Like, what does that mean exactly?
So it's widely understood, I think, that my firm has a really large book of private investments. So that's one example. We have a lot of companies that are either, you know, pre-IPO by a few quarters or up to several years. Mm-hmm. And so that is a real opportunity for us as they're starting to think about, mm-hmm. you know, their public debut in the markets. It's a real opportunity for us to get in there and help form their views about the trade-offs, you know, in corporate governance and the investor perspective, because really a lot of these companies yeah. out in your neck of the woods, they're only hearing a law firm advisor, a financial advisor's perspective that is not particularly kind of shareholder oriented. And then they get surprised, you know, when they do come out in the public markets and ISS starts voting against them and their shareholders, mm-hmm. you know, they don't understand what's happening. So that's one example. But a lot of them are more established small mid caps that just they have a great IR department. We've been talking to them maybe for years on our analyst side, and they just find the current environment of ratings and rankings and, you know, employee concerns and just like the cacophony of ESG stuff that comes at them, they find that very bewildering, and they reach out to investors to find out, okay, where should we start? Like, what's the most important thing? A lot of them just want a list like that, you know, and then we end up talking to them about really like a process to assess, you know, what's most material to them and where they should begin disclosing and what help there is for them, what resources they can turn to. But it's, that's what I mean by coaching. Maybe it's more like partnering. But there are a lot of companies that, you know, are relatively thinly staffed and have just never, they've never sat down to really understand this whole space and their part in it.
So let me touch on the topic of private companies, since you mentioned that, and I do live here in Silicon Valley, where I deal with a lot of these private companies, startups, you know, from the seed round all the way to late stage. And obviously, the one area where you see a big difference is in governance of startups versus governance of, you know, big or at least publicly traded companies. And typically, what I realize is the people who are focused on governance of public companies have a very fixed set, or at least an idea of what good governance looks like. And here in Silicon Valley, people have no idea, right? It's like two different worlds. But in the last, I would say, 5-10 years, there's been a lot of institutional investors who've come, like T. Rowe Price, to invest in these private companies. And that's a really interesting phenomena. I remember reading a few years ago, and it may have been a T. Rowe Price analyst who wrote about Snapchat and the dual class share structure and mentioned, look, you know, we think it's a good thing, because if they would have gone public without the dual class share structure, Facebook would have bought them, and maybe that saved the company. It gave them the possibility to implement the vision that Evan Spiegel had, who was the founder of the company. And it was really interesting, because you could see the thinking of an analyst from a business side versus what I think is conventional wisdom in institutional investors, that dual class shares are the worst things, because you want to have those, you know, votes or, you know, those rights as a shareholder, right? So it's really interesting how these worlds collide. And maybe what is your view as the head of governance of T. Rowe Price? I'm sure this is not an easy question, but it is a very big topic on governance, at least from these tech companies, startups going public. I think if you look at all the IPOs, I would say the majority of the tech companies do have dual class share structures, you know, Airbnb and DoorDash and all the latest companies. So, you know, how do you think about this, and how do you embrace? I mean, that needs a lot of coaching, I would say, right?
Yes. So going back to, you know, my kind of early days in this, I've been doing this voting stuff for a long time, but way back when, it really was sort of a seasonal responsibility, right? There was voting season, and then there was kind of the rest of the year. So most of us who have, you know, a lot of years of experience in corporate governance, you know, found other specialties to kind of fill the off season, or, you know, just developed other expertise where, you know, you could kind of stay busy when it wasn't voting season. And mine happened to be valuation of private investments. In a firm like ours, where you have private investments in vehicles that are priced daily, you have to have an independent investment process. So you need investment-oriented people to help with that process, but you can't have portfolio managers and analysts in there, you know, setting prices of the assets they own. So so that's always just been one of my areas. I've always been on the T. Rowe Price Valuation Committee since I joined. And that has actually really helped to get to your direct question, this intersection of understanding the companies from the time they come into the portfolio through the valuation process, you know, monitoring them as they go. Once you own a private investment, there are, as you mentioned, subsequent rounds that have to be approved. There are changes to the board, changes to the compensation. There are things that we are asked to consent to along the way as private investors that are somewhat vote-like. And so we've always had the governance function directly involved in that rather than some separate private investment group. And I think that has really helped us build credibility with the companies over that long period of time so that when the moment comes and they're talking about their options with IPOs, you know, they know us to be, you know, pragmatic, and they know that we, you know, we want to remain long-term investors in the company. And look, there are different opinions about dual class shares, for example, and a lot of these features. We think of them as trade-offs. We just don't want companies to be surprised. So if they make a certain set of decisions with eyes wide open and they understand what the trade-offs of those, one classic example right now being you can't be in the S&P 500 one day, you know, if you come public with dual class shares that don't expire, you know, we just want to make sure that they're sort of fully informed about those. We think of this journey as a roadmap. It's really not necessarily in our interest for a company to come public on day one, you know, bare and with no takeover defenses or provisions like protective provisions at all. We really do want to see our newer companies really realize their potential before any sort of threat of M&A or something like that might appear on the horizon. And so it is reasonable in our view. We think of it as like a 7 to 10 year roadmap. It's reasonable to start with a classified board and graduate to an annually elected board later. On the dual class question, really over time, we have concluded based on years of experience that structure is not aligned with our interests over time. And I know there's a lot of debate about that. And I know this, you know, the academic, you can find an academic study, you know, to support either side. But our experience is generally generally leads to poor outcomes if you know, over our investment time horizon. So we really encourage companies, and we're seeing more and more of them take us up on it, sunset provision. We are perfectly comfortable with a sunset, a true, you know, time-based sunset provision that you know, gets rid of that structure after 7 to 10 years. That is, I think, a great compromise. In this market, it's time to just be realistic. We are never going to get, you know, a stock exchange ban or regulation. This is a market where dual class stock is accepted. So we think that roadmap idea and compromises like time-based sunsets, once the company really is mature enough to stand on its own 2 feet, that those are the right pragmatic solutions that we can offer.
So pretty much aligned with the Council of Institutional Investors and the sunset of the 7 years around that time.
I think a lot of investors view that as really kind of the perfect compromise for this market where the alternatives are just not, there aren't many.
And I suppose a lot of that also is, I wouldn't say fear, but maybe apprehension towards activists that may come in, and this is one further protection to that. But let me ask you about the current proxy season. And you know, of course, we are in an exceptional year. We've seen many different evolutions, and certainly the ExxonMobil case was the most eye-opening in having this smaller activist engine number one, with only 0.02% of the shares win a proxy campaign, win those 3 seats. Why don't we talk about that case and how do you view that? And also the broader proxy season, and what are the trends that you're seeing and that is different to previous years?
This really was, I mean, just when you think you've seen everything, as long as I've been doing this, I think this is my 23rd proxy season. This was just a very surprising year. But actually, I would not put Exxon in that bucket.
Interesting.
I really felt that anyone who was surprised by that outcome, which clearly a lot of non-shareholders, you know, the press and things like that were, I think they weren't paying close enough attention. I really was not at all surprised by that outcome. And it has nothing to do with really the size of Engine, but really a confluence of a lot of events over many years that kind of resulted in that. So we also, we really don't see this as a watershed event like it's being described as, you know, oh, this is the door that opens and now it's a floodgate of, you know, E&S directors taking over your board. I think the conditions were very Exxon specific. And that same fund with those same directors brought at any other company would have had a different. But in terms of, the rest of the season, I mentioned compensation before. We've been really surprised, actually, by how investors had their pitchforks out over companies that decided to make compensation changes, you know, kind of in the heat of the moment in Q2 last year. We've been much more tolerant, I would say, of the conditions that companies were really facing. And the fact that most of them came out just fine in the end. You know, most of them, the stocks did well. I really fail to see why shareholders are so angry about comp this year, honestly, with a couple of glaring exceptions. I mean, we've been pretty flexible on companies that kind of made reasonable adjustments. And of course, I mean, some large shareholders clearly flipped, you know, their views on shareholder proposals of an environmental and social nature this year. I mean, the numbers we saw supporting proposals like that, some of them can be chalked up to a gradual improvement that we've all seen in those shareholder proposals, both in their content and in the companies that have been targeted. But the numbers this year indicate that clearly some large investors have decided to vote for where they used to vote against. And so those results were surprising, very surprising to me and clearly to a lot of companies too.
And do you think that trend or that train has already left? Like now all of these shareholder proposals are going to really shift what companies are expected to do from their shareholder base?
Our experience is companies, yes, definitely like to be responsive to you know, the mandate of a majority of their shareholders. Again, certain exceptions, but most of the time. But, you know, I'll say something that will probably be controversial, but I do think shareholders have yet to reckon with the fact that the shareholder proposal process in this market has been taken over by non-shareholders. So technically, there's a shareholder behind the resolution, but the real proponent, it was partnering with whoever the shareholder may be. These are, by and large, advocacy groups, social and environmental, you know, activist groups, using the power, harnessing the power of the shareholders, how one of them puts it in its mission statement, harnessing the power of shareholders to foster social change. Some of these advocates, I think it's really questionable whether they want Amazon or Exxon or Chevron or, you know, Kroger to exist in 10 years, right? Like, I think I really question whether our incentives are clearly aligned on the big questions of, you know, climate as a systemic risk and things like that. But when it comes to the interests of the shareholders of this company, having non-shareholders have such important voice, I just think investors really need to reckon with whether our interests are really aligned on kind of the terminal value of these companies.
What has been the drama this year, or did you have any case that raised your heart rate or something? I mean, that would be interesting to know.
I don't want to call it a trend yet, but I have been alarmed this year by the companies that absolutely cross the line from arm twisting into bullying with regard to the vote outcomes. I mean, I just think it's a pretty basic principle that you have to respect that shareholders are entitled to vote the way they want to, and that sometimes the management might not like that outcome. I mean, the Sunday night late calls that we've gotten, the companies that, you know, actually put the meeting on hold for a day or a week or an hour and worked to change the outcome. I mean, this kind of thing is not allowed in a lot of markets, but it's allowed here. And I thought this year they were particularly aggressive. And I think it does boil down to basic respect. And I hope it's not a trend, but I've been pretty alarmed by the lengths that companies will go to engineer an outcome that's not real.
Just so I know, a lot of companies didn't like the way that the vote was going to turn out and basically started calling their larger shareholders, say, hey, can you change? And this happened not only, and of course, we all read on the Exxon case that try to do those late night changes, but this was not an isolated case. And there's quite a few of those that were happening.
It was not an isolated case. And look, to be clear, companies want to lobby, and that's appropriate. We want to hear their perspective. But I'm talking about, 11th hour or beyond, the vote is in and they're trying to change the outcome. The lengths that they will go to surprised us this year.
Wow. Okay. It's really interesting to follow some of these trends. And one of them, I think, is a very strong one, which is board diversity. If you look at the different levers of pressure or of change, right? So institutional investors for a long time have been pushing for board diversity. But now you have NASDAQ that is proposing to the SEC a change of diversity, gender, and also race. And you have California as a state passing laws like SB 826 2 years ago on gender, and just last year, AB 979. How do you see, from your perspective, these changes, and what do you think is going to happen with boards in terms of diversity? Any thoughts, particularly maybe on the quotas on the state legislatures, and you see other states following California's lead?
It is likely to be a patchwork, I suppose, in this market of state level stock exchange, maybe regulation, maybe sort of disclosure based pressure. But so that is true. But this is an area where the pace of progress is pretty surprising, and what it took to get there was shareholders coalescing around this. Like, board diversity is a business issue. It is about, optimizing performance, and it's just pretty hard to find investors who disagree with that principle. And so what we observe around the world is that markets with some kind of hard or soft law, some sort of known market expectation about levels of diversity, they do experience faster progress on this than markets that don't. So my firm did write a letter in support of the NASDAQ proposal. Surprised, honestly, to see the backlash that got. We felt it was very modest and flexible. But yeah, we have to coalesce. I think markets that want to make progress in this area, there has to be some element of a target to it, whether you want to call it a quota or not. If it's just aspirational all the time, guess what? Progress really, really slows.
Mm-hmm. So maybe on the last hot topic in governance and the last biggest trend that we are seeing is at some level prompted by the Business Roundtable, who in 2019 issued a restatement of the purpose of the corporation. And when they said, look, the purpose of the corporation is not any longer to just maximize profits, but we have to think about all the stakeholders. And they put stakeholders like employees, like the environment, like the community, supply chains, including the shareholders. And this has been embraced very much by the business community. And I think 181 CEOs signed in and many others have joined. And it has created a bit of a discussion among the governance professionals. But also some people say, well, it's not much of a change anyways, because under our corporate law, companies still have to think about, all of these constituents. From your perspective as an investor, does it change at all what you do from a day to day? Or do you think it's just business as usual?
Okay. Well, you may call me jaded, but in terms of the letter itself, the BRT effort, I don't put a lot of stock in it. And the reason is that letter came out in August of that year. And, and not in a coordinated matter, but just coincidentally, Lucian Bebchuk and I did the same experiment, which was in that fall engagement season, we asked the companies who signed it, hey, why did you do this? And was the board involved? Did you run it by them? Just give us the context for deciding. And so I won't have the numbers exactly right, but We asked 50 companies that we happened to engage with that fall in regular dialogue those questions. One of them said, yes, the board was very involved in this decision. 48 of them said, no, the board, what do you mean? We didn't talk to the board. And one of them refused to tell me. I mean, if you are really redefining, you know, the order of stakeholders that the board should consider, I mean, to me, it's an obvious, you know, board conversation to have. So that was sort of the beginning of, you know, our skepticism. The second part was in conversations with investor relations people. You know, investors were rather pointedly put at the bottom of the BRT's letter, you know, priority list, right? So you go to an IR professional of any of those companies and say, hey, are we really at the bottom of your priority list? And they will scramble all over themselves, you know, to clarify that, no, we're still all about shareholder value creation here. So it just has not carried, the letter itself, I don't think has carried the credibility that some might, you know, think that it holds. But it definitely is a sign and maybe even a catalyst for some changing definitions in this market and some growing comfort with the idea that other interests should be taken into account. I don't think there's a lot of debate about that. Shareholders understand that our fates are intertwined, you know, with employees and communities and all of that, and that trade-offs, you know, when they are made, are often short-term against shareholder interests, but long-term in favor. For instance, you know, when you see a company raise wages across the board or something like that, I would argue, you know, yes, the stock goes down that day, but long-term, you know, we're benefiting from probably, you know, an improvement in talent over time. So I don't think there's a lot of debate about that, but we did find that the exercise of the BRT letter itself was a little bit hollow. But what do you think? Where do you think stakeholder capitalism is?
Well, you know, I do think that there is a change in communications, or at least there's a change in what CEOs talk about and thinking about employees, thinking about communities, thinking about social aspects, you know, supply chains. Now people are much more attuned to those issues, and it could be the confluence as well with ESG, right? The ENS is putting both the stakeholder view up front of the conversation. And if you listen to, for example, CEOs like Mark Benioff at Salesforce, right? They talk about, well, this is a huge change, right? Stakeholders. And so there is a change that is going on that is interesting in the corporate governance landscape, but it's not new, right? This debate happened, you know, 50 years ago. It happened 100 years ago. If you go back in the history of corporations, there's always been a discussion about how to think about the different players in the ecosystem and how can we make the benefits go to not only the shareholders, but also the employees, the community. And over time, this evolves. And I think now we're in a time where maybe the Milton Friedman strong form of shareholder profits is going to be tempered by what's going on. But I agree that as long as corporate law and Delaware's position is, look, you know, as a director, you've got to make decisions that do benefit shareholders. And it's okay to benefit the other players, but ultimately, it's going to be in the benefit of shareholders. And I think that hasn't changed. If companies want to do something different, then maybe the public benefit corporation, that I think is a bigger change, because now it's incorporated in your charter. And that's, I think, a different discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to phrase it. Tempered is exactly what it feels like right now. Definitely, yeah. The lens has been widened, but you know, the examples of companies going in extreme directions in that way are few.
Yeah. All right, so let's go into the rapid fire questions. Let me ask you, what are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
Well, I don't know about influence, but I just love Wuthering Heights. Wuthering Heights is like the book that I read over and over again. And it was the book in college that reminded me after like so many years of Shakespeare and, you know, books that you had to read that reading was fun again. So I just love that one. And then I would say, you know, on a more serious note, Seven Choices is a book that I loved and gave away. I was married very young in life and widowed actually very, very young. And it's a very lonely experience to be a 25-year-old widow. There's no support groups, you know, for someone in that position. And that's a book that is about unexpected, you know, grief and how to get out of it. And just is life changing. So I do.
And who's the author of that?
Oh, her name is Elizabeth Harper Neild.
Okay.
I keep those on my shelf and I give them away when, you know, circumstances, other people find themselves in tragic circumstances. The book we're reading actually now, our investment club, our investment division's book club is Cast and by Isabel Wilkerson. I really think this is something all Americans need to read. I mean, it just exposes, it lays bare, you know, the gaps that we've all had in our education. It makes sense of, you know, the current, you know, just really helps you explain the historical context for the structural racism that exists today. And it is devastating. I mean, you have to read it with a box of Kleenex by your side, but it really is something we should all read. I think it's clearly going to be one of those books that just changes, you know, my frame of mind forever.
Wow. Those are three great recommendations. I'll definitely add them into our show notes. And who were your mentors and what did you learn from them?
Well, I mentioned I worked at a newspaper right out of college, and I, you know, in college, like all of us, I think, still had this writing style that was all about trying to impress some professor and maybe bluff a little bit and, you know, pad pages and, you know, all those tricks we all learn in college. And an editor there at my paper with a big fat red pen and a week of intense, intense work just absolutely changed my communication style, taught me how to write really in a week. So it was brutal, but it was absolutely, you know, such a gift. And I do a lot of writing, ever have since then. I always think about her. And then Brian Rogers is someone at T. Rowe Price I would point to. He's our most recent chairman of the board. He's retired maybe a year ago now, and he was our CIO for the whole time I've been here. And you know, there's a lot of drama in proxy voting and corporate governance, skirmishes and deals and, you know, villains and heroes. And I can get a little bit excitable about these things. And Brian is just someone with so much perspective, so much experience as an investor. He truly sees the big picture. And he's just always been that voice for me here that's kind of put things into perspective and kind of keep your eye on the ball for the longer term, and you know, damp down some of the conflict that feels very stressful at the time.
Hmm. That's great. Are there any quotes that you think of often or you live your life by?
Give me two classics. Who knows if these people really said this, but you know, they say Al Capone said, "You can get a lot farther with a kind word and a gun than with a kind word alone." I do think of that a lot in terms of even in voting, you know, like how people really care about, you know, our opinion on the company the day before the vote and not so much, you know, a week after the vote. But yeah, not that we resort to violence here, but I always kind of think of that. Like, there's nothing like a big stick.
A Capone in governance. That's a new one.
Yeah. And then I love the Mark Twain quote, "A man who carries a cat by the tail learns something he can learn in no other way."
That's very good, too. I love those. And what is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Well, when I look back, I realize I have spent a disproportionate amount of my travel budget and time over many years in search of weird rocks. I just love nothing more than a rock formation or, you know, Arches National Park, a monolith, you know, Stonehenge. My God, I mean, any kind of weird rocks. If I'm in a town traveling and someone says that there's a rock that looks like Elvis 50 miles away, I will go out of my way to go see that rock that looks like Elvis. Like,
have you been to Machu Picchu?
No, I need to. There's a lot of weird rocks on my bucket list. Easter Island, actually, being
Easter
the
Island.
One.
Wow, yeah, that yeah, th- those really are old mysteries. Okay, great. And which living person do you most admire?
I think the theme that informs, you know, the folks that I admire is generally women crushing it in a male-dominated field, right? Your Angela Merkels and your Oprahs and your, but in keeping it in the business realm, I'm fascinated by Melody Hobson. I just think she's wonderful. If you ever have a CEO of Ariel Investments, so influential in so many ways. And if you ever have an opportunity to hear her speak, you know, you should never pass that up.
Wow. Okay. That's good. Donna, thank you so much for your time to do this podcast. I really appreciate it. And it's great to talk to somebody who, as you said, has had 23 proxy seasons. And that's amazing. So thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing you soon once this COVID is and travel is allowed again. But yeah, thank you for doing this.
That sounds great. I'd love to see you again. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.